This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said on Tuesday aid agencies must be given access to help people in Sudan amid more fighting in the country despite a supposed truce.
We remain gravely concerned about the unfolding humanitarian situation in Sudan, including rapidly deteriorating humanitarian condition. This widespread violence compounds an already dire situation.
Sudan's warring military factions agreed to a new and longer seven-day ceasefire from Thursday. Neighbor mediator South Sudan said, even as more airstrikes and shooting in the Khartoum capital region undercut their latest truce. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is sending additional troops to the border with Mexico at the end of the pandemic policies on May 11th. It's expected to cause a surge in migrants. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman reports from Washington.
Officials in Washington announced Tuesday an additional active duty 1,500 troops will be sent to augment the 2,500 National Guard members providing border protection support. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the action allows Border Patrol and Customs officers to focus on law enforcement while the troops do administrative tasks.
They will not be performing law enforcement functions or interacting with immigrants or migrants.
The deployment is expected to last 90 days. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Russia's foreign ministry has denied a U.S. request for a consular visit to an American reporter for the Wall Street Journal who is jailed on espionage charges. The ministry said Thursday that it rejected the request for the May 11th visit for the U.S., refusing to grant visas to Russian journalists who plan to accompany the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. This is VOA News. UN humanitarian officials said Tuesday any and all ceasefires in Sudan need to be enforced for the sake of people in the war-torn country who need aid. Details from VOA's Jeff Custer.
Speaking at a Geneva news conference, UN Humanitarian Office spokesman Jens Lerke said the ceasefire must be honored for at least two obvious reasons.
We need the guns to fall silent for two reasons. First of all, because we need civilians protected, and clearly they are not. We see a lot of civilians being killed in the hundreds. Secondly, we need that safety for humanitarian organizations to safely get to those people in need, or the other way around, safely for people to move to places where they can access aid.
Lerke urged the global community to donate to UN humanitarian organizations and their partners operating in Sudan as they're facing a funding gap of $1.5 billion. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities near the Houston say they have caught a man suspected of killing five of his neighbors with an AR-style rifle. San Jacinto County Sheriff Greg Caper said Tuesday that 38-year-old Francisco Oropeza was arrested in connection with the shooting in the town of Cleveland. He said that Oropeza was found hiding in the closet of a home under a pile of laundry after investigators acted on a tip. Authorities say the shooting began late Friday after the neighbors had confronted him about firing a gun in his yard late at night. One of the victims was a 9-year-old. Thousands of film and television writers headed to picket lines Tuesday for their first work stoppage in 15 years. Details from Reuters' Tamara Lindstrom.
We're out here to flex our muscles and let the producers know we're not happy with what they're offering.
The walkout sent Hollywood into turmoil, disrupting TV production as the industry wrestles with the shift to streaming. Ellen Stutzman is the chief negotiator for the WGA, a union that represents more than 11,000 writers.
The future viability of their career is at stake, so I think they're willing to do what it takes.
The Writers Guild of America, or WGA, said its leadership unanimously supported a strike after failing to reach an agreement with studios like Netflix and Disney.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he and Chinese leader Xi Jinping have had a long and meaningful phone conversation and their first known contact since Russia invaded Ukraine. In the call, Beijing said it wanted to send an envoy to Kyiv to serve as a mediator to pursue a political settlement. The development came a month after she visited Moscow. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Despite a fragile extended ceasefire, millions of children in Sudan are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance.
More than 50,000 children who were being treated for malnutrition or undernutrition are finding it difficult to access those services.
Plus, the U.S. sends additional military aid to Ukraine.
Extraordinarily strong response to Russia's aggression against Ukraine is at the top of the list, and we are working hand in hand to continue to support Ukraine.
And on World Press Freedom Day, journalists around the world face an increasingly hostile environment. Today is Wednesday, May 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good morning to you. I'm Lori London in Washington. Sudan's warring military factions agreed Tuesday to a new week-long ceasefire starting Thursday, although more airstrikes and shooting in the Khartoum region continued to shatter the latest short-term truce. Still, the announcement of a seven-day ceasefire is being welcomed in capitals around the world and in Washington. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
President Joe Biden had previously called the violence unconscionable and called for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire and unhindered humanitarian access. The United States evacuated its personnel last month and temporarily suspended embassy operations. On Tuesday, the White House said it remains engaged.
We remain in close contact with the Sudanese military and civilian leaders to see what we can to help them identify a path to reach a sustainable secession of hostilities that include humanitarian arrangements, and we are engaged at the highest levels regularly.
And in Addis Ababa, the African Union said Tuesday that they, too, are hard at work on the problem. Decades of U.S. sanctions and testy relations between Washington and Khartoum has led U.S. officials to say that regional partners need to be involved in brokering a solution.
We have agreed on the necessity to intensify collectively and individually all our effort to reach as soon as possible a complete, unconditional, efficient, inclusive ceasefire all over Sudan.
As night falls in Khartoum, many are wondering, is this just a break or a breakthrough? The next few days will tell. Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
As the crowds of those seeking rescue continue to grow at Sudan's main seaport, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates more than 800,000 people may flee to neighboring countries. UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Serrato.
Over 100,000 refugees are estimated to be among those who have now crossed to neighboring countries, including Sudanese refugees, South Sudanese returning, and other nationalities who were themselves refugees in Sudan.
Besides creating a growing refugee crisis, the conflict is worsening an already dire humanitarian situation for children in particular, as humanitarian aid workers struggle to get access to millions in immediate need. I talked about the impact on children with Save the Children Sudan country director, Arif Noor.
So before this conflict broke out, already almost one-third of the population of Sudan was in need of humanitarian assistance. And within that population, women and children were particularly vulnerable. So there was already a huge number of children who were suffering from malnutrition, and they were being supported by the international community. So from the numbers we have right now, it seems that more than 50,000 children who were being treated for malnutrition or undernutrition are finding it difficult to access those services, and that puts them on additional risk. So this is the first and foremost impact of the visible impact of this conflict. Then we know that around 19 children have lost their lives. More than 50 have been injured. And these numbers, we have the reason to believe, are grossly underreported because there is no regular data recording and reporting mechanism in place. Whatever systems were in place before the conflict broke out have broken down, and there's no way to collect precise information from the conflict affected areas.
I understand electricity has been impacted, and that in turn has destroyed some other vital things like medications and vaccines. Is that accurate?
That's pretty accurate. So most of the places, specifically in Khartoum, have been without electricity for several days. even the neighborhoods which have had electricity, supply of electricity is not consistent. So you may have power for 4 to 6 hours, and then you will lose power because the power is being generated by using fuel, and there is a overall shortage of fuel within and around Khartoum. Plus, there has been widespread spread damage to infrastructure, which also includes the supply lines for electricity. So that has also caused another disruption. And then obviously vaccines and some other medicines require a cold chain to be maintained. And that has become difficult in the current circumstances. In addition, in Khartoum, more than 80% of the hospitals have been rendered dysfunctional because of the damage that they have received over the past almost now 2.5 weeks.
We talked a lot about the impacts to children's physical well-being, but what about the unseen? What about their emotional well-being? What kind of impact is this having?
From what we are hearing from our colleagues who are in the field, the children are extremely scared because of all the violence that they are seeing. And many of these things will manifest maybe once we have better access to the children and we are able to better assess their mental and physical well-being. But it's clear that in such situations, not only the physical health, but the mental health of children is severely affected.
Is aid able to get in at all?
That's the main challenge. There are two parts of this challenge. So one is to bring aid to Sudan. And once it reaches a certain location, then how do you take it from there to the most affected areas? The government has closed the airspace, which means that the commercial flights, everything else has been stopped. Even the aid agencies are finding it extremely, extremely difficult to bring even the most essential supplies into the countries. And once you have brought it into the country, then how do you take it to the people who need it most? So that's the second part of the challenge. It's not easy at all.
Dr. Arif Noor, Country Director for Save the Children in Sudan. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much, Laurie.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken welcomed his Czech counterpart to Washington on Tuesday with plans to collaborate on a wide range of issues, with ongoing support for Ukraine high on the agenda.
The extraordinarily strong response to Russia's aggression against Ukraine is at the top of the list, and we are working hand in hand to continue to support Ukraine, to continue to exert pressure on Russia for its aggression against Ukraine, and of course to work on supporting refugees, humanitarian assistance, economic reconstruction. The Czech Republic has some 500,000 refugees from Ukraine, and that support is quite extraordinary.
Also Tuesday, the U.S. announced it's sending Ukraine about $300 million in additional military aid, including an enormous number of artillery rounds, howitzers, air-to-ground rockets, and ammunition as the launch of a spring offensive against Russian forces approaches. A Palestinian Islamic militant leader with Islamic Jihad died in Israeli custody on Tuesday after an 87-day hunger strike, according to authorities, the first such fatality in more than three decades, as tensions around the Gaza Strip spiked as the Islamic Jihad and other Palestinian factions swore revenge. Alice Rizzo with Reuters has more.
Qader Adnan, who was awaiting trial, was found unconscious in his cell and taken to a hospital, where he was declared dead after efforts to revive him, Israel's prison services said. He had previously refused the service's medical care, it added. Disputing the prison services' account, Adnan's lawyer, Jamil Al-Khatib, and a doctor with a human rights group who recently met him accused Israeli authorities of withholding treatment. It's the first such fatality in more than three decades, and tensions around the Gaza Strip spiked as the Islamic Jihad swore revenge. Hundreds of people took to the streets of Gaza to rally in support of Adnan and mourn his death. And the Israeli military said three rockets were fired into Israel from the Strip. In his hometown near Jenin, in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, Adnan's nine-year-old son, Ali, led a protest march. Carried on a man's shoulders, Ali chanted, "Qader, you are a hero," as Palestinian men chanted back. There were no immediate claim of responsibility for the Gaza rockets reported by Israel. Since 2011, Adnan had conducted at least 3 hunger strikes in protest at detentions without charges by Israel. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Association, Adnan had been arrested by Israel 12 times, spending around 8 years in prison, mostly under so-called administrative detention or detention without charges. Israel says such detentions are required when evidence cannot be revealed in court due to the need to keep intelligence sources secret. Palestinians say they deny due process of law. The prison services said that this time Adnan was arrested and indicted in an Israeli military court on charges that included links to an outlawed group and incitement to violence.
Alice Rizzo with Reuters reporting. Here are some of the other stories we are following from around the world. Participants at a United Nations-convened international meeting on Afghanistan in Qatar agreed Tuesday to work together to find a way to engage with the country's Taliban authorities on issues such as human rights, counterterrorism, and anti-drug efforts. This as Afghan protesters took to the streets of Paris this week, demanding the international community refuse to recognize the Taliban. Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. Tuesday told reporters he was, quote, as concerned as you could possibly be about China's activities in the South China Sea. Marcos's visit to Washington comes as the U.S. and Philippines look to deter China's increasingly aggressive actions toward Taiwan and in the disputed South China Sea. The World Meteorological Organization reports the likelihood of the El Niño climate pattern developing later this year is increasing. And this, it warns, is bad news, as El Niño would likely fuel higher global temperatures. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
People now depend on various video chat tools to meet face-to-face with family, friends, and colleagues without being in the same physical space. Researchers at Northeastern University and MIT in the U.S. and Scotland's University of Glasgow suggest in a new study that pet parents can also be taught to connect and meet new feathered friends via video chat. Throughout the study, parents contacted each other whenever they wanted to. The researchers saw that the parents often participated in social activities, such as preening, singing, and playing. They also learned that parents who made the most video calls got more calls in return, which suggested to the research team that taking part in the study helped the birds become more social. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. With Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan facing a tough re-election challenge, opposition and non-government organizations are stepping up efforts to ensure a fair vote amid growing concerns over voting security. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
It's busy in the Istanbul office of the nonpartisan election monitoring group, Türkiye Gönüllüleri. Staff are recruiting volunteers to make sure they have enough people to cover Turkey's general elections on May 14th. Ayça Yücel is a coordinator for Türkiye Gönüllüleri.
We need at least 200,000 people. At the moment, we haven't reached that point yet.
The group trains staff through telephone support, online videos, and face-to-face meetings. The monitors learn how to collect voting numbers at polling stations and to collect those figures to ensure the official results are accurate. Damla is a student and volunteer monitor. She says, as a young person, I cannot live the way I demand. I cannot live the way I desire. And that is why I want to protect my vote. Opinion polls indicate an increasingly tight presidential and parliamentary election. The government says all steps have been taken to ensure a fair vote. Despite this, officials say there are still concerns about voter security. Türkiye Gönüllüleri has recruited a team of lawyers who will help monitor the vote. Volunteers are also being sent to Turkey's earthquake-struck Hatay region. Tamer Balam is the provincial coordinator for Türkiye Gönüllüleri. He says those who remained here have concerns, saying, I wonder if our votes will be stolen. Observers say Türkiye Gönüllüleri, along with other election monitor groups working with political parties, played a key role in helping to ensure 2019 votes were fairly counted in a hotly contested Istanbul mayoral election. Officials say the 2019 Istanbul vote has motivated some to watch polls more closely. As parties step up their campaigns, some observers say the role of election monitors could be pivotal to the outcome of the polls. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
May 3rd is World Press Freedom Day. It comes amid a growing trend of governments detaining journalists to use as political pawns. And as Reporters Without Borders just released World Press Freedom Index for 2023, which shows that journalists around the world face an increasingly hostile environment. Olivier Dubois, a French journalist in Mali, was kidnapped in April 2021 and held prisoner for 2 years. He had been in Mali covering a story about two militants' movements engaged in conflict. Dubois was freed in March of this year and shared his story with Annika Hammerschlag.
What was going through your mind once you realized you were being kidnapped?
It's a bit weird, if you want, because you have to know my trust in my fixer, in my contact, was strong. And so during all the driving, the 4 hours, after a moment, I say, fuck, it's 4 hours now. My fixer will be maybe worried about the fact I don't come back. And they say to me, oh, no problem. We will phone him. We will contact him. No problem. And I say to me, okay, I think it's for their safety. You know, it's not common to have a journalist who come to do an interview. So maybe they want to do that on the night. And maybe I will come back next morning. It was my first idea. Maybe just 4 days after, I really understood I was kidnapped. Because when they say I'm kidnapped, I say, okay, it's a mistake. It's a little evil jihadist. They don't know. I have an agreement by their chief. So I think in maybe a few days, they will see the mistake. They will release me. But it wasn't a mistake.
So after you realized that you had been kidnapped, can you just kind of walk me through that first week, the first month, the first year? What was it like?
It's rough because it's totally different from a normal life. You have no bed, you have no underwear, you have no, no comfortable things. You have a chain around your ankle all the night. You live with gunmen. They don't speak French, most of them. The food is not the same. The sun is striking, is really hard. So it's totally different. But in 1 week, and I think it's one of the human power, you can adapt. Adaptation comes quickly. The first days were hard. But after, step by step, you begin to develop an adaptation of that. But you can imagine it was really difficult. First 10 days, you just sleep on the nature, in the sand, on the ground, in the roads, rocky area, under trees, with all the insects and the little creatures you can imagine. You are not really quite comfortable because you are prisoners. You are in jail, in open sky, but you are in jail.
So how did you get through that? Were you able to kind of transport yourself mentally somewhere else?
Yeah, I think it's one of the main things who permits me to stay at the top. So no interview, and I was kidnapped. So I developed a sort of feeling of injustice, you know. And this put me in a sort of resistance. Directly, I don't know, the three or 4 days after my kidnapping, I've decided to build a program, to build a schedule every day to develop myself physically and mentally, through by sport, to do observation, to try to have information, try to be busy, to have a goal, to overcome all the obstacles in this captivity. And it worked most of the time, in fact. And if you continue to do your job, you are a journalist. I was still a journalist there. This permits me to stay well.
Can you walk me through what that was like, being released, seeing your family for the first time, having freedom?
It was really, really, really great. Explosion of feeling in you. It's like you are not yourself. During 2 years, you just think about the day this day will come.
That's former captive French journalist Olivier Dubois speaking with Annika Hammerschlag. Well, fans of Taylor Swift can now admire some of the musicians' most famous looks at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee. The museum is currently staging a pop-up exhibit consisting of a selection of iconic costumes worn by the 12-time Grammy winner. Through Taylor Swift's Eras includes a total of 10 outfits that represent each of the artist's 10 albums. Among the items on display, a faux fur jacket and bikini Swift wore on the music video for You Need to Calm Down, a circus ringmaster ensemble she wore when performing We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together at the 2012 MTV Europe Music Awards, and a multicolored fringe dress from her Fearless tour in 2009. And disposable vapes used by more than a million Australians will be banned under sweeping new reforms. The government wants to end the sale of e-cigarettes in shops in the most significant tobacco and vaping control measures in a decade. This has been International Edition on Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States designated a widespread sanctions evasion network that works for the benefits of Hezbollah financer Nazim Saeed Ahmad under its counterterrorism sanctions authority. Ahmad himself was designated by the United States in late 2019 for providing material support to Hezbollah, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization. On April 18th, the United States Department of State and the Treasury Department imposed sanctions on 52 individuals and entities for facilitating the payment, shipment, and delivery of cash, diamonds, precious gems, art, and luxury goods for the benefit of Nazim Saeed Ahmad, a Lebanese art collector and diamond dealer. Nazim Saeed Ahmad leads a global network of family members, associates, and companies that exploits weaknesses in the regulation of diamond, precious gem, and art markets to acquire luxury goods. The network utilizes both legal and illegal means to induce participants into falsely engineering certificates, thus allowing Ahmad to manipulate diamond prices and taxes, and to purchase or co-sign high-priced luxury goods and artwork from auction houses and galleries worldwide. The network undervalues invoices for such imported luxury items through seaports and subsequently moves assets into Lebanon without paying the applicable taxes and duties. Key sanctioned individuals include Firas Ahmad, Nazed Saeed Ahmad's son, who handles many of his father's business affairs in South Africa. Nazim Saeed Ahmad's daughter, Hind Ahmad, who has brokered deals on behalf of her father and helped create an alias to help him evade sanctions and purchase artwork from U.S. companies. Rami Baker, his brother-in-law, who served as a proxy for Nazim Saeed Ahmad and his many companies in Lebanon and Angola, and his wife, Rima Baker, who handled the shipping and logistics of importing millions of dollars of art from the United States and foreign art galleries into Beirut, and helped him circumvent U.S. sanctions. The individuals involved in this network used shell companies and fraudulent schemes to disguise Nazim Saeed Ahmad's role in financial transactions, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian E. Nelson. Luxury good market participants should be attentive to these potential tactics and schemes, which allow terrorist financiers, money launderers, and sanction evaders to launder illicit proceeds through the purchase and co-signment of luxury goods.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.